The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. And this week, we bring you Hollywood in crisis, or at least some sort of crisis related to Hollywood. President Trump has declared that there will be a 100% tariff slapped on any movie made outside the United States. Any foreign film or any film that is filmed outside of the United States. It's hard to say exactly what's going on. I have Richard Rushfield, a columnist for The Ankler and a good friend of this program, here to kind of unpack the impacts of this and just discuss exactly what is going on here and what this all means. And Richard's also going to stick around to talk to me about Thunderbolts, which is the new Marvel Cinematic Universe movie that is out now. He went to the world premiere in Los Angeles, although he has some thoughts about the food that was served at the world premiere. His thoughts about the movie and mine are fairly equal, and Richard will be along in just a few minutes to talk about that. And we're also going to talk to our contributor Matthew Ehrlich about The Four Seasons, a Tina Fey produced and written remake of the 1981 Alan Alda movie. Yes, you heard me right. The Four Seasons is back, and it's about as unimpressive as you might expect. Matthew and I have a very amusing conversation about that in a little while. But first, Richard Rushfield is here to talk about the new Trump Hollywood tariffs situation and also about Thunderbolts. So let's play a trailer for Thunderbolts right now, and then we'll talk about tariffs, we'll talk about Thunderbolts, we'll talk about The Four Seasons. We're just going to talk. We're going to talk and talk and talk. Talk to you in a second. So I was sitting on my sofa on a Sunday night watching the Dodger game, as I do most Sundays, most days, really. I watch way too much baseball. It's so soothing, especially when you're a Dodgers fan, because you know that they're going to win 65% of the time. And then my wife was sitting near me, and she was looking at her phone, and she said, "Oh, shit." And I said, "What is it now?" And she said, "Trump just announced that he's going to be putting 100% tariffs on all movies made outside of the United States." And at that moment, I knew that my Monday was lost, that I knew exactly what I was going to be doing on Monday, which is dealing with the fallout from Trump's movie tariffs. I'm the editor of a publication called Book and Film Globe, so I'd be remiss in my duty if I didn't at least try to spend some time picking apart what this means. I still have absolutely no idea what this means, actually. So I've enlisted the help here on the podcast of a putative expert on the business of Hollywood, my friend Richard Rushfield. Hello, Richard.
I hello there. I'm licensed to say I have no idea. I'm not just clueless as an amateur. I'm professionally clueless.
You're professionally clueless, like most people in Hollywood. Richard is a columnist and a founding light of The Ankler, which is I consider the leading online newsletter and or Substack, whatever it is, of Hollywood business affairs. They cover a lot of stuff, and I find them extremely valuable and useful.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's just, you know, I don't know if you're not interested in that sort of thing. Maybe you won't be. But I mean, if you have any interest in the business of Hollywood, The Ankler is a great place to turn. So I thought, well, maybe Richard has some thoughts about what's going on here, and I don't think you really do. Well, you
have. Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I have a few to a very small number of thoughts, small to zero.
Well, as we were talking before we started, you know, Trump has this committee. I would call them the Expendables of Hollywood, old Hollywood stalwarts, John Voight, Mel Gibson and Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
An act, really, a geriatric action movie worth of select Hollywood people. And they've been sort of advising him on what's going on and how to reclaim Hollywood for America, for MAGA. Do you think that they had anything to do with this?
Well, it was announced this weekend that John Voight had a plan to save Hollywood. Mm. It came out in various publications. And then this weekend, after the word that he had a plan, he went to Mar-a-Lago and met with President Trump. And John Voight has a production company which makes all his movies in Bulgaria, I'm told. So so this may not have been exactly his plan. So one suspects the conversation might have gotten away from him there at some point.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, it's telling that he had that meeting this weekend, and then on Sunday night, the King Donald issued this decree. Yeah. I imagine, you know, nobody you know, tootling around Austin today seemed to be affected by this, particularly, at least in my purview. But I imagine there's some concern on the ground there in Los Angeles about what all this means.
Concern and confusion. Now, because there's, you know, we have one of our major studios, our five studios, Sony Pictures is a Japanese studio. So are they not allowed to, are all their movies being considered imports? And then pretty much there are basically no movies that film in America anymore. Its production has left American shores entirely, and bringing it back is not the thing. Is movies in the best circumstances are kind of barely profitable. Like when you have to green light a movie, the financial picture to put together has so much kind of wishful thinking and belief and everything else in it to make you think like you should invest this $300 million in making this movie because you might make a profit off it, which movies these days don't do often enough. And that when they film overseas, the amount that it saves them on the production is actually, it's actually about 40% that they save by filming in England or Hungary, which are the two major hubs now.
So England and Hungary offer massive tax incentives,
yes,
for the studios to film there, right? And they have top-notch facilities that are in part funded by those tax incentives. So I can see how a policy in America to provide similar tax incentives to sort of counteract this offshoring of jobs and production. I mean, it makes some sense, right?
I mean, that's what Hollywood's been calling for a while here. And was part of the Voight plan as it was leaked. But yeah, that's what the Motion Picture Association and the lobbying for that has been. They've been calling for these for incentives to match or approach the incentives offered by the likes of England and Hungary, and Malta is another hot hub right now. Yeah, but tariffs are not that. There's something different, and what they will be imposed on, and how is we don't watch a lot of foreign movies here. So
no, I mean, there are occasionally a foreign movie will break through sort of into the Oscar circuit. You know, Parasite won Best Picture. You have movies like Triangle of Sadness or Flow that get nominated for stuff, but well, then you have stuff like, for instance, the movie The Substance, which was a big hit this year. It's set in Los Angeles, but it was filmed in France because the director and writer is French. But is that a foreign movie?
You know, it depends. Who financed it? Who put up the money? I mean, a lot of the, like say, every Sony movie is financed by foreign money. So are you going to say goodbye to Spider-Man because he's owned by Sony? You're gonna get by without Jumanji? I'd like to see you try that, Neil.
I personally could get by without Jumanji, but you know. I just don't see slapping 100%. But who are you tariffing? Are you tariffing the company? Are you tariffing the distributor? Are you slapping it on the production costs? You know, who, or is that just all something that we're going to have to pay at the box office? And then what if you have a monthly pass? You know?
Otherwise, those Corrieta films that you're sneaking out to every night are going to get pretty expensive. that's gonna run up a big Correia bill.
What was that Brazilian film that won? She's All That, the one.
That the Walter Salles film.
I mean, I saw that because I have a monthly pass to the Alamo Drafthouse and I see a lot of movies. But you know, but it's like, what possible economic benefit is there going to be for tariffing something like that? And again, are you going to tariff Walter Salles?
Exactly. So looking at the last year's films, I'm trying to find if there was a film in the top 100 that was of the domestic box office that was a pure foreign film. I don't think I could find one. Here we go. At number 88, Kalki 2898.
That sounds like anime.
Yes. Anime produced by... It's a movie from Vijayanthi Movies based in Hyderabad.
India. So it's Bollywood.
Hyderabad. Bollywood came in, was number 89. So, you know, get out and see that quick before you got to pay $25 for it.
Well, okay, but so the question is like, so the real problem is not that we're being invaded by foreign movies. Although if you watch Netflix, there are plenty of foreign movies on Netflix, but it's not
TV are not part of this though.
Which is ridiculous. So it's like you're basically like, I think he's conflating things, right? Like the problem is that production has been offshored. So the Hollywood or film business equivalent of the middle and working class is not working here.
Yeah, which is a real problem, but real thing. And we here in Hollywood have talked a lot about how to bring that back. And the best way to do that is with incentives to get the money back here. But we don't know what this tariff is on and who is on. He doesn't seem to understand it.
I think we have to look at this as like he's expressing interest in the issue. You know, it's like a declaration of intent.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe he will get distracted before
it happens. Part of the problem, too, and we've written about this a lot on Book and Film Globe, is that, you know, Trump doesn't have a lot of friends in Hollywood. You know, he has three friends that, you know, people do not. He's not popular in Los Angeles and in Hollywood.
So could it be that with tariffs lingering, and this is an invitation to these studio heads who haven't been very nice to him to stop by and have a chat while he's thinking this over?
Yeah, well, I think that's fair. And also, like, you have to look at this is not like his war on American, on Harvard, on Columbia, his war on American universities with whom he has like a genuine ideological spat, right? Trump famously likes movies. He's been in some movies, you know, he's a showman in general. So I just don't understand like why he would declare war on the movies.
If you look at the sectors that he's gone after, academia, the law firms, he seems to be finding these sectors that are pretty uniformly Democratic and on the left, and coming up with ways that he can help them.
How they can help him. Basically, he's trying to bend them to his will. And yes, Hollywood is a notorious lib factory, but I don't know. But again, movies are for everyone, and this strikes me as it's just a very odd moment. It's either a declaration of war or an offer to come to the negotiating table, or both.
Well, I think it's a declaration for all these folks to think long and hard about what they're doing and how they live their life and who they want to spend their time giving money to and making fun of.
Yeah, well, that's something I do every day, Richard.
Yeah.
So let's switch now, because you know the thing is like one of the things we've been covering here lately is that, you know, movies are actually doing quite well and we're having an excellent season at the box office and the summer is looking quite bright. I reviewed the new Marvel movie.
Yes, Thunderbolts.
He's stronger than all of the Avengers rolled into one. Who will keep the American people safe?
The Thunderbolts!
Who are you?
We are team.
A scrappy anti-hero. Yeah!
Asterix.
The Asterix, as it turns out, because I'm just going to give it away. The Thunderbolts are actually the new Avengers.
What? I thought the Eternals were the new Avengers.
Nope. That did not take. But these Thunder, they're going all in on these Thunderbolts. And you actually attended the world premiere of this movie.
I did. I was there. I will say about it that... surprisingly limited buffet options. I hate to just lay that out before your viewers, but you're accustomed to a lot of different stations with a lot of choices, or at least three or four. And pretty much it was a grilled chicken, a pasta, and a salad option at every one of the stations. So
I mean, that sounds healthy, but somewhat disappointing, perhaps.
They were good quality. It was not. I mean, it didn't leave like
you weren't hungry. You didn't leave the premiere hungry.
Yeah, but I would have portended a film that offered such a limited selection would have a troubled for opening weekend at the box office.
But it didn't. It did pretty well. And it has been pretty well received. I saw this movie. I just had some popcorn that I paid for.
You paid for your popcorn.
I go to the movies like a civilian, Richard. I don't attend premieres with the Rizzler.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I understand. I hope you got seconds then.
I did get a refill. I didn't finish the refill, but I did what the Rizzler would have done, which is scarf it.
Yeah.
All right. But you know, the thing is, like, you know, this movie, it was charming enough, right? I mean, I can see why they're trying to hang their hat on Florence Pugh and the son of Kurt Russell and the son of Bill Pullman.
I found it. You know, I definitely suffer from superhero fatigue.
Sure.
And going to every one of these, I'm sort of like, I'd be happy to never see another superhero movie again in my life. But I thought it was, this one had more talking and emotions and making jokes and less kind of alien armies throwing office buildings at each other, which the actors were... You know, very strong cast. So, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I mean, my wife asked me how it was. I was like, well, it had Florence Pugh and, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus was in it a lot. You know, it's kind of like if Selena Meyer from Veep were, you know, 20% smarter and were in a Marvel movie. Yeah. Pretty much playing that character. What I found curious, although I didn't mind this actor, was that, you know, essentially this was a sneak introduction for this new character in the Marvel Universe called Bob.
Yeah, Bob. And they make a joke of saying Bob a lot, which is
a lot of Bob. It was kind of like when we went to see that Muppet, Jason Segel Muppet reboot, and it was all about Walter when really we wanted to see Kermit.
That's right. Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know, it had a little air of Itchy and Scratchy's new pal Poochie.
And people have noticed when at some point, without giving away Bob, there's a costume change of Bob, and people have noted the similarity between the changed up Bob and Homelander from The Boys is pretty striking if you look at it
a little bit, but without even remotely the satirical brilliance. You know, they don't really commit. They don't really commit to the bit. And this is a character from the comic books. I stopped reading comic books when I was 12 in 1982. So this was a character that was introduced after my time. But I looked it up, and he is a legitimate character.
Oh yeah, okay.
The sort of what Bob is and what he does. So it is somewhat
in the comics. Does he? Do they give him another name at some point? Does he get a superhero name, or is he always just Bob?
Yeah, he gets a superhero name. Although his name is, but even when he gets a superhero name in this, they still keep calling him Bob. You know, and I will say this:
it's hard to walk away from that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's also hard for you and I who grew up watching the Bob Newhart show. You know, you just keep expecting when you hear someone say Bob, that's just kind of, you keep expecting exactly. Bob Newhart to walk through the door. And he's not. He's not walking through the door. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is walking through the door. And she's also a good sitcom, you know, sitcom actor.
I'll say this about her. I'm no bigger fan of Julia Louis-Dreyfus than myself, but But I don't feel like they let her go full Selina Meyer here. I feel like it's kept on a bit of a leash.
A bit. She's been MCU'd. She took the check.
Yeah.
She took the enormous check that Kevin Feige wrote her, and I don't blame her for cashing it. And not only that, like, she's clearly not, this is not her last appearance in the MCU. I will say that, like, I see a lot of, I would assume young millennials or Gen Z people talking about how this is a movie that really deals with, like, feelings and depression and issues related to depression and all that. And I'm like, I guess that's true. You know, if you're 12 years old and you've never thought about why you feel sad sometimes, Thunderbolts might resonate.
Yeah, well, they, again, without giving away too much, a critical plot point in a battle. There is a battle in the movie, so
there's a few.
Sorry if I spoiled that, but a critical plot point comes with a group hug. A group hug plays a huge role here, which is not what you typically see in Marvel battle scenes.
Yeah, that is not taken straight from the Avengers. So the new Avengers are more in touch with their feelings than the old Avengers were. But I have to say, like, again, the cast is pretty good, but, you know, you're really dealing with extra heroes at this point. Like, you don't have the Incredible Hulk or Thor flying or leaping and flying around. These are truly, like, tertiary characters. It's popular because it's Marvel, but I'm also like, boy, we're really, like, they're really expecting us to devote ourselves to these very marginal characters.
I didn't even really care about Iron Man, though, like, when from my comic book days, like, that Iron Man was kind of a secondary character in the golden Marvel age, don't you think?
Sure, but, you know, compared to what they've got now, Iron Man is Superman. Yeah. I mean, he's like, we know Iron Man so well. Yeah, so there were, it's true. And there's been a lot of sort of secondary and tertiary characters that Marvel has thrown our way as they've expanded this universe. But this is like literally the central team that we're talking about.
Yeah.
This isn't a side quest. This is the main.
I mean, they are, as you revealed, they are the our new Avengers. Where they're going to be part of our lives for 100 years now.
Although Marvel has led us down these paths before and then abandoned it as soon as someone, like, you know, commits sexual assault or something.
Oh, yeah. Provided David Harbour can behave himself.
As long as he can keep it in his pants, as long as Florence Pugh doesn't say something racist, I think we're going to be okay. I don't know if Hollywood's going to be okay. They're facing threats from the Red Hulk in the White House.
Yeah, I'm not. I wonder where this one. Marvel used to be all filmed in Georgia, but I believe they've been moving a lot of their shooting overseas there. So
all I know is that they had better start carving out some space in Universal City.
Yeah,
because we're in for it if they don't. All right, Richard, thank you so much. Keep fighting the good fight there in Hollywood, and we will talk to you soon.
Pleasure to be with you.
It is rare to find your soulmate, and yet somehow all six of us have done it.
Cheers. Nice reset, honey.
Put your brights on.
What's wrong with you?
I feel a little.
Some things don't need to be remade. Some things don't really need to be made at all, but they made a movie called The Four Seasons. Alan Alda made this movie back in the early 1980s. And now there's a remake of The Four Seasons, an 8-episode remake of a movie that people didn't really like that much at the time when it came out. And it was created by Tina Fey, of all people. And I have Matthew Ehrlich, of all people, really the best person to review The Four Seasons.
Hey, Neil. Happy to be aboard. Yeah, great.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to going on vacation with you and your boyfriend and me and my wife. And then one other random heterosexual couple. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, I would say that apparently the original Four Seasons was a modest box office success and a critical success.
Yes.
But what comes to mind is that, you know, there's this like when you talk about pop music, there's this terminology called, you know, an imperial phase where a pop musician has such goodwill and such cultural cachet and so much star power that anything they release goes to number one or enters the top 10 because you will give it a chance because it's that artist. And I think what was happening was that Alan Alda was at the time, you know, such a beloved figure in the late 70s, early 80s, MASH being such a cultural juggernaut, that anything that he did at that time just seemed to be magical and, you know, serious and wonderful. And I think that a lot of people went out and saw the Four Seasons and loved it. But then a few years later, everyone was scratching their heads and going, what was this?
I recall my parents, for instance, being fans of the film. I think, you know, it was kind of like as you said in your review, it was kind of like Neil Simon light.
Yeah.
And Neil Simon himself was light.
And Neil Simon himself was pretty light to begin with. Yeah.
You know, I in terms of Alan Alda, Neil Simon-ish vehicles, I'm more of an aficionado of Same Time Next Year.
Right.
For instance, which is sappy, but you know, but has some rom-com charms. You know, at the Four Seasons, I frankly didn't, you know, it's not something that had occurred to me in many decades. And so I was surprised to see that it was being remade by Tina Fey, you know, who, it's not like Tina Fey's output is universally perfect, but it tends to have, a lot of it tends to have edge, right? You know, even right. Her most recent sitcom, Girls Five Eva, that has some edge.
And then I'm wondering, you know, I was just thinking maybe Tina Fey herself is someone who just enjoyed an imperial phase where everything that she greenlights, you know, becomes a thing. And so she was kind of allowed to make this because she's Tina Fey. And she seems to have a lot of affection for Alan Alda. She had him on 30 Rock to play a recurring character, Alec Baldwin's real father. And she's spoken very highly of him on various podcasts. And so I think maybe there was a sense that like this was her way of paying tribute to him, even though otherwise I don't see why this thing was remade. And even the way she remade it was just, you know, confusing and perplexing.
Now, you watched all 8 episodes. I couldn't go any further than the first two. But, you know, the thing that really struck me about this remake of The Four Seasons is how completely tone deaf to the zeitgeist it is. You know, we live in an age of, you know, populist revolt against effete bourgeois liberal East Coast intellectuals. And which isn't to say that those people don't still exist, but I just feel like if you're going to make something about that culture, it's got to have a little bit more of an edge than this thing does. And it just feels so self-satisfied and entitled.
Yeah, it seemed to exist in a time that doesn't, I'm not, you know, even like Your Friends and Neighbors, for instance, people have been saying that it's like a couple of years too late. It's capturing the zeitgeist of something that's already passed. I don't even know that there was ever even a zeitgeist for what this is describing. It's like three different couples who all seem to have a connection through maybe college.
And an unlimited amount of money.
Right, right. But like Will Forte is supposed to be a teacher. So yeah, it's one of those like, where's the money coming from for all of these things?
Well, Steve Carell's character is a hedge fund manager. Ostensibly, although he's as soft as a baby's bottom in the show, so it's like he doesn't really seem like a hedge fund manager. He seems like also kind of like a teacher, right? Well,
the hedge fund manager has become like the architect. Like, you know how in 70s television everyone was an architect.
Yes.
It seems like everyone's a hedge fund manager right now, and I don't even think that the people who write these things know what a hedge fund manager is. It just sounds like a job an adult male would have.
It's shorthand for a lot of money, basically.
Yeah, right.
And you know, and he has this terrible marriage to Carrie Kenny Silver from you know, who was Trudy in Reno 911.
And I don't know, you know, in the original, her character is played by Sandy Dennis, who is infuriating but adorable and very compelling. But this woman did nothing for me either way.
No,
I just couldn't. I was like, oh, he's leaving her. Okay, yeah, I'd do the same thing.
Yeah, because she doesn't enjoy life and she just plays Farmville all day.
Yeah, yeah.
But the show doesn't make it funny. It just makes it kind of pathetic.
Right.
I would say, you know, Tina Fey and Will Forte's characters, they're the sort of the the normal sane relationship, right?
Right.
You know, first of all, I can't watch Will Forte without thinking of MacGruber.
Right. And I don't think that Will Forte is really meant to do straight, like whatever Robin Williams did in Garp, where he's still playing a comic role, but he's not being Robin Williams, and he was able to do both. Like, I don't think Will Forte has that in his wheelhouse. Yeah.
And Tina Fey is disturbingly flat.
Yeah.
Which isn't that surprising. If you've seen her try to do dramatic roles, like in that Kenneth Branagh Haunting in Venice movie, she is not an actor.
Right. She's not... I love her as Liz Lemon in 30 Rock.
Of course.
Because she's playing this exaggeratingly self-loathing, quirky version of herself. But in this, it's almost like she's trying to be the relatable, mature, there's nothing there. There's no there. I don't know. I can't get a read on this character at all.
Yeah, very bland. All right, but let's address the gay elephant in the room. There is, they have added... To make this a modern show, they've added a gay couple.
Added a gay couple, yes, exactly.
Played by Colman Domingo and some Italian guy.
Right. Marco Calvino. Yeah, I don't remember his name either. He's very cute, but he is demonstrative.
He's cute. He's physically cute, but he's not very interesting.
Yes.
And I would say the same thing about Colman Domingo, physically quite beautiful.
I think Colman Domingo is wonderful, but I feel as though he's being brought in to do double duty as the person of color and the gay.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up this question in your review, right, Matthew? Like, why would this fabulously good-looking, you know, glamorous-ish gay couple go on vacation with all these every year, not just once? Every year.
No, four times a year. It's called the Four Seasons. They go away every season. And I'm like, oh my God, do these people have any other friends?
Right. I don't think I think we've been on, I've been on vacation with another couple once in the last decade.
Right.
You know, usually just my wife and I, sometimes family, sometimes our son comes, sometimes we have some other family along, but it's like, no, it's like, I have friends. I think I have friends. I'm not entirely sure if I have friends, but, the idea of going on that many vacations is just it's completely insane.
Yeah, I mean, you really can just see the writer's room, and they're going, okay. In the original, all the three couples were white and cisgendered. We got to have a gay couple. We got to, you know, like it's just it doesn't feel organic. It feels like a nod to we've got to update this, but it doesn't really feel as though where did this gay couple come from in the terms of these people's lives. I mean, I guess they went to college together. But you know, even so, 30 years later, are you still vacationing that often with someone you went to
college? Yeah, I went to college with gay people. I've never been on vacation. I'm friends with some of them, but I never went on vacation with them.
Right.
Like you said, like you said in your piece, don't these guys get a house on Fire Island, right? Or somewhere. Provincetown, isn't that another one?
Right. Puerto Vallarta.
Yeah. Puerto Vallarta. Exactly. It's like, but you know, that might have been a more entertaining show if the straight couple had to go on a gay vacation just once.
Yeah, exactly. Give Colman Domingo his own show. Goddamn.
Yeah, there we go. Well, where do they go for the winter? Do they go skiing?
Skiing, yeah, or someplace warm, like.
No, I'm saying, where do they go in the show for winter? I missed the winter.
Oh, you know what? I didn't actually get that far. I lied. I didn't catch the whole thing.
I only made it through to spring when the kiln predictably blew up.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm in fall right now, where they're going back to Vassar College, where they all went to school.
They went to Vassar.
They went to Vassar, as did I.
How relatable. I was like, well, it makes sense. I'd be like, yeah, they probably didn't go to Penn State or something like that. All right. That makes sense that these are Vassar people, which makes the show even less relatable and even less interesting. My God. The Four Seasons, now airing on Netflix. You know, watch it with your four closest friends. You know, one of those couples might be going through a sad divorce.
And have some wine and have some crawfish and laugh and love and jump into the water.
Now that sounds horrible. All right. Well, I don't want to watch any more of the Four Seasons, but I will definitely read Matthew Ehrlich's review of the Four Seasons TV show a couple of times, because it's very entertaining and you should read it too. Matthew, thank you so much. And have a great next vacation without me.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Matthew Ehrlich. The Four Seasons is now on Netflix. Thank you to Richard Rushfield for discussing Thunderbolts, which is currently in movie theaters and will eventually be on Disney Plus or Hulu or whatever, wherever you get your Disney content. And also, Richard tried to help me unpack the tariff situation in Hollywood, which is a bit confusing at the moment. And I'm sure it'll straighten itself out like all policies seem to these days. There's nothing confusing going on at all. It's just so easy to understand. I'm Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. This is the last show we're going to do for a couple of weeks. I am going on vacation with my wife. We've been married for 25 years, and we're going to go somewhere in the world to celebrate that fact. It's worth celebrating, and you'll survive. You'll survive without the show for a couple of weeks. Keep reading the site. It will continue to publish without my help. And I'll be back in a few weeks with a new episode where we'll talk about the things we always talk about. Thank you so much for listening and for reading the site. And I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.